Then they said on that documentary, it was hundreds of miles away. Come back, they have some sort of calming sense and everything. So there's, you know, they seem to be able to tune into certain signals or whatever. Whatever. I don't think it's telepathy. But, you know, it's just little things like that that stick with you. And the word that is just people.
AC2GS. Well, you know, animals have other senses than we do. Insects have a fourth color. They see ultraviolet. There are some birds that are able to detect magnetic fields. So there are other signals that can be perceived by other animals that they can act in ways. But to learn to do a specific maze or whatever, that learning experience is, there's no practical way to present a premise where that would happen. And, you know, it sounds kind of ridiculous if you think about it. I mean, how did the two labs get together? You know, where the Russian and I think American get together one day and talk about this weird behavior their mice had at the same time? I don't, you know, that sounds like a very apocryphal story.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of similar things, not along this line, where, yeah, you know, one country is doing something, and, you know, they find out, you know, they have these seminars and forums, people get together, and, you know, just, it was interesting, it was something, you know, I don't know where they got that from, unless they just totally, I hope not, they're just totally fabricating it. You know, Rogan said, yeah, I heard about that too, you know, I have no reason to doubt him, but, you know, then again, I don't know. And, are they just making this up? I don't know, but at this day and age, it's very possible. AC2GVS, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, I would tend to think that they made it up. Joe Rogan, I don't think, is particularly a malicious person. He's not a terribly well-educated person. He tends to go for things, and he probably knows that the more sensational and absurd, the happier a lot of his listeners are, and he gets paid very, very well. I tend to frown on people who promote pseudoscience. It confuses the heck out of people and gives them a wrong idea about almost everything. When a guy who I think barely got through high school you know, kind of suggests that he's smarter than Albert Einstein. I think the guy's got a psychological problem, personally. I don't think he's discovered the flaw in quantum theory and relativity. I think it's much more likely that he's a severe narcissist with delusions of grandeur.
Yeah, agreed. It's entertainment at the least. It's entertainment at the least. And I don't know why they've always caught my attention and I kind of detect it. All right, listen, again, great net, and I'll be on the side here listening, and somebody else jumps in.
Okay, very good. John, did you ever read any of Eric Von Doniggan's nonsense?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was recommended to me when I was 20. A little student in the old RCA Institutes, which by that time was GCI. And, yeah, I did. And I find a lot of his stuff, look, you know, you can't prove it, but it seems to be based in logic. And, you know, I think he puts forth very good, you know, logical arguments. What's your opinion?
I thought he was a complete fraud, but an entertaining fraud at the time. I read his stuff when I was in sixth grade. And a lot of times he faked some things, and other things, it's, you know, in the eye of the beholder. You know, you see some kind of a fire going, you know, flying out of something's mouth, and all of a sudden it was an ion trail of a rocket ship or some equal nonsense. I think most of his stuff has been refuted decades and decades ago, but, you know, to a young kid it was entertaining. Pseudo-fact. He's still remembered. There are loads of other guys doing nonsense like him. A lot of alien visitations. They can't possibly believe that you human beings could build pyramids for some strange reason when ultimately you're just stacking rocks on top of other rocks. But for some odd reason, we need aliens to do it for us. So I just was curious if you enjoyed his literature at the time.
Yeah, you know, I did. And I think I put a little more credence into what he says than you do. And it's all speculation, you know, but by all means. What I found interesting was things depicted with the halos around their head and, you know, how you compare that to an astronaut helmet, which wouldn't be exact, but, you know, a transparent helmet. And then you got to ask yourself, well, why were they depicted with halos? And, you know, so I think he, again, puts forth an argument which could be considered logical, and it's up to, you know, everybody to, you know, accept it, deny it, or you know, at least consider it. So, yeah, I enjoyed it, and I think it was the book. Fascinating. I'll give a minute, and I'll think about it. Oh, so thinking of it, it just had a very interesting background. It was recommended to me by a girlfriend, and she told me the guy wrote the book, and he brought it to a publisher, and they said, no, it's not going to sell. Long story short, he had it put in print himself and went around to these health food stores and, you know, asked them to sell it, you know, with the order to profits, etc. And long story short, it hit the bestsellers list. And it was a thing of, it incorporated, you know, a wage that set into ring theory and all of that, which at that time was pretty new. I'll think of it. It always happens to me at the moment. It'll come to me a little later. Jogs your memory on anything.
Not particularly, but, you know, there's always next Sunday, John. But, you know, in those days, you have to keep in mind that the Romans had a big thing where they honored the people they wanted to honor by giving them laurel wreaths to wear. So it's not a big jump from a laurel wreath to a halo. It's much more consistent with a laurel wreath than it is the rim of a space helmet that I don't quite know why saints would be wearing space helmets. It's not like the gospel mentioned them going into space ever, and it would be kind of weird for them to wear it upside down, too. So I think it was just a projection of something like laurel wreaths. Also, it was that saintly people were illuminated by the light, and you were almost couldn't look at them. It was a big thing in religion in general. God himself could not be gazed upon directly, but only indirectly or by angels, because his voice would blow your eardrums out and his countenance would just kill you. So I think it's more like that than helmets.
Yeah, the name of the book was Celestine Prophecy. And, of course, as soon as I unkeyed, it came to me. Yeah, you know, there seems to be a lot of questions these guys, like Montana and the others, raised about the building of the pyramid. Some people can explain it, but then they kind of just dismiss their claims as being, listen, you know, say the truth. I don't know enough about civil engineering to lift these kind of blocks, you know, ropes, and et cetera. And then arguments about they were taking these stones to quarry so far away, and supposedly rocks found with perfectly round holes in them. And, you know, how much is this stuff true or not, you know? We're kind of at their mercy at that point, you know. I mean, it's interesting at the very least. I think it's worthy of at least speculation. I get the impression from you, though, you dismiss it, and, you know, I'll defer to you on that. You know more about the science than myself or most of us, so, you know, I'm sure you got reason, too.
Yeah, I mean, the stones were taken from a distance, but they were taken over the Nile River. The stones were cut close to the Nile River. The pyramids were near the Nile River, and they had a lot of boat technology because they all lived near the Nile River. So that's where the stones went from one place to another. And they've kind of demonstrated through practical demonstrations that, yeah, if you have enough people and you have the purpose, you can pile stones on top of other stones. So, you know, I think it unfortunately insults our ancestors that they couldn't possibly do it themselves. They needed some green guy who's 4 feet tall to do it with levitation rays. But, you know, you're free to have your opinion. It's a free country, and, you know, yours is just as justified as mine.
Well, you know, look, again, I always respect somebody who has opinion and more knowledge on the subject, but that's for sure. What's your take on all of this with the some of these pyramids with their alignment, stars, and supposedly they found, maps of the universe. And again, it's just what they're putting out there, so whether it's fact or not. And, the calendars with this accuracy, et cetera. Any thoughts on that?
Okay, well, yeah, the calendars are accurate because the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians back in their time were very good engineers and mathematicians. A lot of what we take as Greek math is actually Egyptian. That was taken from Greeks when they traveled to Egypt. So they were very smart. And it's an aspect of the Mesopotamian numbering system that we use for the calendar, you know, things like 360 and things that are multiples of 12. It's because the ancient Mesopotamians and Babylon and such used a 12-based number system, and they calculated all the astronomical things because it was very important in farming and agriculture, which was made them a big, powerful nation-state. So I think, again, it's just human beings being relatively clever. I don't think the pyramids are lined up the way that other people kind of discussed, because the rotation of the Earth shifts. So whatever it was when it was built 4,000 years ago is different than it is now. And they say that if you take the length and you multiply it by 4.3 times 10 to the 32, it's near the number. Well, you know, where did you pick up the other numbers? So I think it's wish fulfillment. I think it's cherry picking. And I think it's reverse engineering, personally.
1 second,
LBJ, comment.
You're a medical doctor. Maybe you could say that. I believe it. She told me testosterone is directly linked to wish fulfillment.
No, there's no real thing as wish fulfillment. Wish fulfillment is magic thinking. Magic thinking is very common in children. If you think about something and you want it enough, it suddenly appears. That is against the laws of physics. You could think that there's $1 million in front of you from today until next Wednesday. You're not going to get a single bit of currency kind of pop into existence. So since I don't believe in wish fulfillment, I don't believe testosterone improves wish fulfillment.
Just a attempted humor, Roy, that's all. It's more like fantasy. Wish fulfillment is fantasy, that's all.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, I often wish such a thing existed, because there's a lot of bad things that happens in each and every one of our lives that we would like to think our way out of it. There's another gentleman that, unfortunately, I'm doubling with. If you want to speak, I'll let loose the push-to-talk button.
Take it to LBJ. Just one comment. Now, setting aside all of, about the pyramids and who built them and how they built them, there was just one coincidence that just piqued my interest, and I really don't have an opinion about the rest, so I'm not that smart. But the latitude that's equivalent to the speed of light out to, I forget how many digits, 8 or 10, passes right over the peak of one of the pyramids.
The problem is that you're choosing the speed of light in terms of meters per second, right?
Yeah, that's what they claim. Except isn't a meter 1 millionth the distance between the pole and the equator?
I'm not quite sure that's exactly how they derived it. It was, I think, pretty much an arbitrary measurement. It's fundamentally was based upon a bar of inert metal that was kept in France and recently has been defined as a number of waves for a certain frequency. So the problem that I have is that they would the aliens would have to know that 4,000 years from now we would make up a meter and adjust accordingly. Up until the 1700s, there were, really was no such thing as a meter. So why didn't they pick a foot? Or there's probably thousands of other length measurements at the time to choose from. So it's, again, cherry-picking, and it's kind of meaningless. The ancients had no concept of what a meter might be.
That's exactly what I thought when I saw it. It's just a coincidence, but I just thought I'd bring it up.
Okay, yeah, I mean, people do that all the time. There are people who do numerology with biblical entries, and they foresee the future and the past and the present and all manner of things. If you generate a lot of random noise, the human mind loves to build patterns, so it will build a pattern that turns it into something sensical, as rather than a completely random event. It's just what our brains evolved to do because it was important in our survival, and we don't know how to turn it off. That's why we look at clouds and we see animals. We look at stars and we see animals and all kinds of things because we're pattern recognition machines.
Yeah, that's another subject I could talk for hours about. Unfortunately, I have to head to work. But, boy, it was great talking to you and everybody out there. 73s, and hopefully I can join next week.
73, I hope you can. You know, hopefully there'll be a lot more Sundays down the road, so we can talk about all those things. I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. It was loads of fun. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a couple of things. Hope it didn't annoy too many people. So everyone, I'll be back a little bit later to close things down, but it's time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report.
Okay. You know, I'm doing the math. I remember that story, too. 1 millionth of the distance between the North Pole and the equator. That definitely rang a bell when he said that. So I don't know what came first, you know, the chicken or the egg. Did that come first? And then they say, well, develop a rod that's close to that number, and we'll put it in the vault.
I don't know, Paul.
Unfortunately, I have to get to work, but, yeah, I'd love to extend this conversation. Anyway, again, guys, 73T2LBJ.
Okay, according to good old Google, the French Academy decided on 10 millionth of the distance from the equator to the North Pole as measured along a line that passed through Paris. So, again, seems a bit arbitrary to me. How did they know it was going to be through Paris? It could have been through Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. Did you say 10 millionth?
It's somewhere within a square on the
top. It was divided by 10
millionth,
not 1 million.
Okay, you two doubled. But Google says It was defined as 1/10 millionth of the distance from the equator to the North Pole measured along a line that passed through Paris.
Very good, very good. And I know he had to go, but that's good. Well, we'll be in next week. Week in, week out. Year in, year out, hopefully. Hopefully. SpaceNet Report. We'll do that. Tomorrow, there's a launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And it's not SpaceX, not, you know, United Launch Alliance, you know. It's not anything like that. It's a completely different company. They've launched four other times before called Firefly. And, you know, I'm following these people. They're getting bigger, quicker. And a lot of the smaller companies, from, you know, that have started up in the rocket industry. He's got a rocket called Alpha, this company, and they launched nine engines. They're called reefer engines, and you know, it's not a small rocket, but it's not a large rocket either. It's medium lift, but they've got some success. Government has gone with them for a couple of contracts, and now this one is for NASA. And NASA has a half a dozen CubeSat satellites attached to this vehicle, and they call it it's ELANA 43, or it stands for Educational Launch of Nano Satellites 43. And there's a bunch of them, but I took note of one called Serenity. And they call it Teachers in Space. Anyway, Teachers is a 3U CubeSat. The CubeSat is normally a cube that's 10 centimeters cubed, you know, roughly 4 inches. And this is a 3U. And when they have a 3U, that means it's equivalent to three of these things attached together. That's how big it is. And it is an amateur radio transmitter. You know, what you're going to be able to do is ping the satellite, and it will give you the different science coming from space. It'll give you the health of the spacecraft. It'll give you the battery charge, the solar panel voltage, you know, longitude, radiation levels, and apparently it's also going to be able to transmit pictures, and I assume this is all on the amateur frequencies. I haven't gotten the frequencies yet. I'll listen to the news line tomorrow night that usually comes on the Limark right after the swap and shop, so 9:30 you hear news line, and they tell you everything that's going on in the world, and they tend to always mention a space topic that's going on. And maybe they'll give the frequency. I looked it up. I haven't found it yet. But that's pretty good. And then 5 other different science CubeSats are going to be going up as well. But Firefly is a good company. They are expanding. They are developing a lunar lander. One they have, I think it's called Blue Ghost. That they plan on launching that. There was a plan to launch it by the end of the year. I'm not sure if they're going to make that. They decided that they needed more locations to launch rockets. This will be the 5th launch for the company out of Vandenberg. They were going to sign a contract with Florida to launch out of Cape Canaveral, but they decided it's awfully crowded there. so many other companies already there, so they're taking a spot not too far from here, about 400 miles or so, at Wallops Island, Virginia. They're going to use another launch complex that's located there. The Orbital Science used to be called Orbital Science, was sold out to Grumman, Northrop Grumman, and they launched the Antares rocket out of Wallops. And most of the time they have the Cygnus spacecraft on top. Cygnus is a cargo vehicle that docks with the International Space Station. Well, they're going to use that complex because Northrop Grumman is not launching the Antares for a while. They're rebuilding it. They need to change out the design, do away with the engines that they do have. The engines that they had were Russian-built RD-181 engines. And because of Ukraine and all, years ago, it was decided not to depend on any Russian technology, so they signed up they signed up with Firefly. Firefly will not only launch Alpha rockets out of Wallops, but they're building bigger engines, well, Miranda engines. They're gonna put them into the Antares rocket, completely do away with the Russian engines. So within a year or two, they'll be able to utilize the same launch complex, the same pad, which it's making that place a little bit more active. You know, they always launch the Antares, and then they had the Minotaur that they launched out of there. They have been lately launching the Electron rocket, which is built by Rocket Lab, another small launch company, very successful. Just launched their 50th rocket. So a lot of activity going on now, not only in Florida, but in Virginia, in Wallops Island, Virginia. Rocket Lab eventually plans on, well, they're actually doing it now. They have a large manufacturing facility now in Virginia, and they're working on the new version of their rocket. Instead of the Electron rocket, they're going to call it the Neutron rocket, and that will be a completely reusable spacecraft. On that, I expect that to launch within, well, I always claim within a year. I'm going to guess within 2 years from Wallops Island. Busy place lately. Any comments, put in that. This is WS2N.
KE2HJU. Paul?
Good evening, Charlie. We missed you last week. How you doing?
Last week, I couldn't stay awake. I had a rough weekend. I'm sorry to have missed you. This new Electron rocket, is the engine going to be reusable as well as the spacecraft?
Okay, here's the story. The Electron rocket is the one being that's been very active. They launched 50 times so far from a company called Rocket Lab. Peter Beck owns that company. Rocket Lab is an American company. They come out of California, but most of their launches are taking place in New Zealand, the North Island of New Zealand, and they have launched a couple of rockets so far out of Virginia. So they have engines already. They're called Rutherford engines. Well, it's not a gigantic rocket. Each engine has 5,000 pounds of thrust, and you have 9 engines on that rocket. But it's plenty of power to get a couple of hundred pounds, I think maybe 500 to 1,000 pounds into orbit. And that vehicle right now is not reusable. They're working on it. It comes down in the water. You know, they have a parachute, and the parachute opens up that first stage with those engines. Are destined eventually to be reusable, yes, but not the second stage. Now they're working on a bigger rocket. The same company, Rocket Lab, is working on not the Electron rocket, but the Neutron rocket. The Neutron rocket is a much bigger engine, and they name their engines Archimedes engines. You know, they everybody likes these different names, and a much bigger rocket. I would say medium to heavy lift vehicle. So it's going to be a much larger rocket. It's going to be liquid methane, going to be liquid oxygen. The Electron rocket is liquid kerosene, refined, kerosene and liquid oxygen. But the new one is going to be liquid methane. And that will be, his goal is to make that rocket completely reusable. Let me drop it. The design I saw on it would launch from, in this case, Wallops Island, Virginia. It would go into orbit. The first stage would come back down and land near, or maybe on a barge. They're thinking about another a barge type of situation near Wallops Island, and they would reuse that first stage. The second stage is encapsulated in the front of the rocket. So imagine this big rocket going up. And then usually you have the fairings that fall away from the rocket. Picture the fairings just opening up like an alligator's mouth, and then having the second stage come out of that, and that goes off and does its job like normal. you know, it might go into orbit. Maybe it'll go to the moon, wherever it's going. It'll do its job putting a satellite up into space. But these alligator jaws that just opened up will close. You know, instead of doing away with the fairings, they'll close. And they'll be part of that, you know, that neutron rocket will then re-enter the atmosphere and come back and land near Wallops Island on a barge or something. That's the plan for Rocket Lab. They haven't done that yet. Maybe neutron, like I said, might go within probably a little over a year. You know, the way things go, maybe 2 years. Back to you, Sean.
Yeah, I got one question about the International Space Station. Are they having problems returning to Earth?
Well, there's a contract that was just given out to SpaceX to deorbit that thing. You know, it's not going to return to Earth. It's going to burn up in the Earth atmosphere. Similar to what they do with all their cargo vehicles, or most of their cargo vehicles, the Progress cargo vehicle, or the Cygnus cargo vehicle, or the HTV cargo vehicle from Japan. When, you know, when they go up there and they drop stuff off, in fact, SpaceX has a cargo vehicle as well. When those things are done, all of them except for the SpaceX vehicle, over the South Pacific Ocean. You know, they deorbit them, and that's where they, you know, that's their graveyard. SpaceX, their cargo vehicle, comes back down and splashes down in the Atlantic Ocean, or lately they've been splashing down in the Gulf of Mexico as well. And this way they could, you know, get all the science stuff and things, you know, off the spacecraft. But the other one's burned up. Now, this International Space Station, I mean, that's the ultimate goal, is to actually have the whole space station burn up over the South Pacific Ocean. But to do that, you need a very large rocket. They're hiring SpaceX to do it. I thought they were going to get maybe their Starship, their new vehicle. But they said no, they're going to use the a version of their Falcon 9 rocket that they've launched literally 300 times now. So that's a reliable rocket. They plan on somehow attaching that to the space station to slow it down, to deorbit it, and eventually burn up over the South Pacific Ocean. Many years from now, though, you're looking at, I'm guessing, well, they said 2030 in the report, but it's probably going to go 2030, 34, something like that. That's my guess when they eventually do this. Back to you, John.
Now, when they build the new space station and they send up these section of the space stations, how do they inflate them?
Oh, you're talking about the inflatable ones. Yeah, there's, I don't know, probably at least four companies I know of that are planning on putting stations into space, hopefully before they deorbit the International Space Station. See, we've had continuous people in space since 2000, so we're up to 24 years of continuous space presence, you know, for the United States. Of course, we have Russia and on board and, you know, international. But it's called the International Space Station. And now, like you're talking about the inflatable one. Let me just go over a couple of the other ones. There's something called Star Lab. Star Lab is going to be built by a couple of companies. Main company is Voyager, and they've got some other companies involved, including Grumman and Aerobus. They're going to build something called the Star Lab. Now, that won't be inflatable. There's another one that is involved with SpaceX. It's a very small one that they might go up for you know, a week or two and come back with maybe two people on board, maybe three. Then there's the orbital reef. That's massive. That's as big as, like, probably as big as the International Space Station. And that'll be built by Blue Origin, that's Jeff Bezos. And that, you know, there's going to be a bunch of docking ports there. And some of those docking ports will be able to accept other modules, and they'll be inflatable. Then you have, I think the one that you probably saw is called Life. And that's the one being built by Sierra Space and another company. That's the inflatable one that you probably see on the computer. And that's quite large. It's inflated with nitrogen. The walls of it are inflated. The walls are very thick, probably 8 to 10 inches thick. So it goes up compressed, and then they have these nitrogen tanks that go up with it. And naturally, the whole thing is all compressed. It's able to fit into a smaller space, a planche, and then these things inflate. The walls are so strong that they say they're like concrete, you know? I mean, really solid. They don't leak. Radiation proof, they've proven that. And also, if it's hit with little micrometeors, it's able to handle that as well. And I say they prove it, and the reason I could say that is they actually have this thing attached, a smaller one, attached to the International Space Station. It's called Bigelow. Bigelow went up, I think, 2014 or 15. What are we in? Yeah, probably around 20. My guess around 2015. It went up, extended up in the trunk of their cargo vehicle. They had a robotic arm, the one that's attached to the space station, install it into one of the ports, the aft port of the Tranquility module. So they installed it, and after it was installed, they inflated this thing. And this was years ago. This is probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And it inflated, and you wind up with around 400 cubic feet inside. So enough to, you probably put like 3 or 4 people in there comfortably. You know, I've seen pictures with 6 astronauts inside, you know, crowded in there, and they take pictures of them. And this was a test of this inflatable technology. And they were going to leave this Bigelow module, by the way, the Bigelow module, that was they called it BEAM, B-E-A-M. It was stood for the Bigelow Excursion Module, inflatable module. And they said, well, in 2 years, after it was inflated, we're going to disconnect this and let it float away and burn up in the atmosphere. But it was so good and so great, and they said, let's leave it permanently attached to the space station. That's what they did. They actually used it for a storage area, you know, put stuff in it. And all this time, they have sensors inside. They can detect radiation. They can detect radiation, heat, temperature control and all, and pressure, of course. They haven't lost any pressure, and it's been up there for years. So that's the technology that it's built on. Bigelow now is out of business, but other people have picked up that idea. So that's the inflatable one. But there's another space station planned by Axiom. Axiom is going to attach 3 modules to the front of the International Space Station, to the Harmony module. And these are, you know, big, huge modules. But, you know, they have 14 feet in diameter, maybe, you know, 25 feet long. And they're going to attach these things to one another over the next couple of years. Right? When it comes time to deorbit the International Space Station, these 3 or 4 modules built by Axiom, they will actually separate from the International Space Station and go floating away. and they're going to become their own space station, their own commercial station built by Axiom. Yeah, it's got its own solar panels, and, you know, battery backup and all of that. It's got its own big cupola deck where you can, you know, float inside and look around at space and Earth. It's really it's a great idea, and they're building it now. They're actually building modules that are under construction, so that's a plan for the future of the International Space Station. Charlie, back to you, WS2N.
This one module that I saw had to be 60 feet long by about 20 feet wide, and it had sleeping areas for about 10 people, and a bathroom down the end. I thought it was something really like, wow. And it can take space.
Yeah, that's the one that I think you're saying is one. It's called Life, being built by Sierra Space. Unless you're looking at an older video where Bigelow, the one that went out of business, they had plans of this really big inflatable unit, and I believe that was going to be 1,400 cubic meters. It's a massive thing, multiple floors and all. That, you know, if it's that one by Bigelow, then you know that one's been canceled. But there's other ones which are not as big, but one I think they call it Life, and that's by Sierra Nevada. That's inflatable. And now you have this other one that's not inflatable that they plan on launching on a SpaceX Starship as one whole piece. That's a different one as well, but that'll be about 26 feet. So, anyway, a lot of things to come, Charlie. A lot of things to look forward to. We could always talk about. Back to you, Charlie.
I got one question. At the International Space Station now, they have a helium leak?
Yeah, the helium leak is on Starliner. That's the one that went up June 5th and docked with the space station June 6th. They thought they might come back within a week or two, but that's been delayed for a number of reasons. They want not so much the helium leak. They know what to expect from that. They know they could deal with that. In fact, it was leaking before they launched, and they said it could be leaking 100 times more than what it is, and they won't have a problem with that. But they're looking at the thrusters. They've had problems with the thrusters before. There's around 62 of them total around the whole Starship. Not the space station, the Starship that went up that brought the crew of Sonny Williams, who's a ham, and Butch Wilmore up to the space station. They're still up there, and that's what you see on the news. Oh, they're stranded in space. Oh, they're not stranded in space. In fact, I just heard the news conference. It was a tele-news conference. An hour and a half, listen to that. And Boeing and NASA was telling the news media, don't tell people we're stranded in space. We're not. We're ready to go. In fact, if there's a problem on the space station for any reason, you know, a micrometeorite hits the space station, we have a leak and we have to get out, or if there's a fire or something, everybody has their own seat. Right now, there's seven people on the International. There's nine people on the. Everybody has a seat. Enough spacecraft up there for everybody has a seat, including Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore, who went up in Starliner. They would have a seat as well. They'd be able to get into their spacecraft, Starliner, supposedly all kinds of problems with leaky or everything.
That time,
and,
complete.
You know, the way the news media makes it sound like the thing is, you know, on its last leg or something. But there's nothing wrong with it. They would use it as a lifeboat, just like everybody else would use their own spacecraft as a lifeboat. And they would all deorbit, and they would fly back home safely. There's nothing wrong with the spacecraft to get these people home. Well, the reason they're leaving it attached for so long, and it might be up there another month when we drop it. The reason that they leave that attached is that NASA and Boeing are doing studies on these thrusters. They want as much information from these thrusters as possible. Because next year they plan on sending another one of these vehicles back up to the space station, and this time with a crew of four. And they're trying to gain as much data as they can while they are attached to the International Space Station. And that's the reason they're doing it. And one of the tests that they're doing actually right now is down in White Sands, New Mexico. They have a couple of these thrusters that they have on board, and they're constantly testing them. Firing them, you know, hundreds of times and evaluating them and then trying to compare that to what they actually have on board. The reason for it was when they went up and they were going to dock with the space station, they came within the distance of around 2 football fields. They called the keep out zone. And at that point, they slowed down, they stopped, let me drop it. They evaluate things. Well, they noticed that 5 of these small thrusters were not operating. And now they figured out why. It has to do with the software. And the software is detecting some anomaly with them. So the software shuts them down. They overrode that and proved to themselves that all those thrusters worked. Actually, one they won't bring back up. But just 4 out of the 5. So there's only one that's not working. They don't need them at all, really, to get back. They have so much redundancy with the spacecraft, triple redundancies on how to get back or originally how to get to the space station. So that's what I know about it so far. We'll be following it. Back to you, Charlie, WS2.
Okay, so there's nothing to worry about.
Very good, Charlie. Yeah. You said it in a couple of words, which I should have did. But, yes, exactly. Nothing to worry about. Sonny Williams was a ham, and Butch Williams, the other astronaut, very happy up there. These people have spent months up there in the past. It's not their first rodeo up on the International Space Station. So they're very happy with the other crew of 7. They're doing well. I just want to mention that there was supposed to be a couple of spacewalks up there, EVAs, but that they were canceled, and due to a water leak from Tracy Dyson's not the spacesuit. Again, the news made it. Oh, it's a spacesuit. Yeah, it's a connector. I went to the spacesuit. It's an umbilical connector. I guess it's a quick disconnect that you would use, that they probably use. These quick disconnects have data, power, cooling water, and, all these astronauts, before they do a spacewalk on the space station, they put the space suits on and they hook these umbilical connections inside the space station, inside one of the rooms called Quest. And inside Quest, they connect to it, and they can sit there for hours at a time if they wanted to. And they would use their oxygen, water, the cooling water, and electricity from the space station. And when it's time to leave, what they do is they disconnect from that, and then they open up the hatch, and they blow it out, and they do their spacewalk. But at the point where they disconnected, they noticed there was frost all over, coming out, and wound up on Tracy's shield, not the inside, but the outside, and therefore they were really in no danger. They were on, they were on their own backpack. But then they really realized they reconnected. They reconnected to the umbilical, and the quick disconnect apparently went back to normal. So they canceled the spacewalk, and then I guess NASA's going to evaluate everything, and my guess is they'll probably eventually change out those connectors. That's my guess. Anyway, we're getting to the end. It's after 11 o'clock, so I'm going to turn this back to Roy. Let me drop it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your questions. And we'll be back on, hopefully, tomorrow on the Limelight Club InfoNet, which is always on these frequencies. And the only difference between that net and this net is the InfoNet comes on at 8:30, and this one always comes on at 8. After the InfoNet, that's followed by Swap and Shop. George usually does that. And then that's followed by my Newsline. So, all right, we're going to turn it back to you, Roy. AC2GS, this has been WS2N. Happy 4th of July, everybody, coming up. Back to you.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the Space Center Report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I especially appreciate it, as I appreciate everyone who participated today. I hope you enjoyed the net. I hope you learned a few things. I hope you were amused and entertained. And I hope you'll join us again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do this all over again. As Paul mentioned, have a enjoyable and safe 4th of July. Don't blow anything up that you have any use for anymore. You know, you only get 10 fingers. Keep them as long as you can. So as per always, I want to remind people, our rebels now are done. Dick used to end his text nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And I always like to put in good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open to a degree. Don't pull it all the way open. Your brain will fall out. So find a happy, optimized compromise where you listen to other people's ideas and you weigh them and you think about them and you research them a bit and you decide what's valid and what isn't valid. So everyone, have a great week. Be well. And as always, I will be clear after I say Slava Ukraine.
KE2HAU73, and I'll speak to you next week.
73, Charlie.
W. W2RON in Milton, Vermont. I'm listening for any calls.
W2RON, B2. Can you hear me?
I hear someone calling, but you're very noisy. It dropped out a little in the middle of your identifying. Would you give the call again, please? This is W2RON in Milton, Vermont. The station, come back, please.
KE2DPY, W2RON, can you hear me?
Yeah, KA2DTY, I believe. Yes, I do hear you. It's a little noisy. I guess you're on the fringes of the machine. I'm in Vermont, and I'm working off of Echolink, W2RON. My name is Ron. Over.
Ron, KE2DPY, Kilo Echo 2, Papa Yankee. Yeah, I'm talking on a handheld right now. I'm in Massapequa, New York.
Okay, you're in New York. I didn't get where you were in New York. I thank you for coming back to me. I usually run a handheld here too, but I can't make it into, and only one machine can make it into. So I use Echolink. Anyway, I wish things were a little better. I could hear you better. But my name is Ron, Radio Ocean Norway, Ron. And we're 35 miles from the Canadian border in northwest Vermont. Over.
Northwest Vermont, that's quite a hike from here. I'm in Massapequa, New York, 11758, Massapequa, KE2DPY.
Oh, I know where Massapequa is. I'm a transplant from Bayville, Long Island. I was county near Oyster Bay, Glen Cove area. I lived in Bayville. I've been here in Vermont for about 21 years. So I'm very familiar with Massapequa and Valley Stream and all Baldwin and Deer Park and, you know, that's sure. I lived on the North Shore. But I got around the island quite a bit. So a school bus for a number of years. Worked in Manhattan in the motion picture industry for many years. And now we live in here, up here in Vermont. Answer is 86, over.
What was your reason for moving to Vermont? Retiring over there, or do you have family over there, a job?
Yeah, we retired here. We retired here 20-some-odd years ago. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. Half acres up here. 2.5 acres, and we're about a half a mile from Lake Champlain. Over.
Well, fantastic. I hope you're enjoying your time there in Vermont. I'm just getting started over here in Nassau. I work HVAC industry, and I own my own business. We're booked in the National Lab out east. Really enjoy here in Nassau. This place, I came from Suffolk out north, where I grew up and where I was living. And my girlfriend lives over here. Enjoy a beautiful area. Thank you.
Yeah, Nassau County is very nice. We lived in Nassau County for over 20 years. We originally lived in Queens County in Richmond Hill near Aqueduct Racetrack. Of course, they're closed now. And I traveled into Manhattan to the motion picture business for many years. When we moved from Queens, Richmond Hill to Bayville, continued to travel into Manhattan to work in the motion picture field. Anyway, there you go. Very pleased that we had this chance to talk. You're not holding the machine. I don't know. I know where Massapequa is. I just don't know where the machine is. But you must be on the fringes. with a handheld. Anyway, I'm not sure what you do for work. You did mention it, and you talked about labs. But anyway, yeah, Nassau County is a great place to live, and we enjoy it there. This is W2RON, over.
I do heating, ventilation, knitting, refrigeration. Been doing it just about 10 years now. Travel all over the place.